Well, this evening I shall conclude my discussion of American federalism looked at from the view of a contemporary American jurist. And I suppose in concluding I can do no better than to go back to the beginning with the classical, by reference to the classical description of the American federal system, and that classical description of the American federal system is contained in the famous Federalist Papers. They were published in newspapers in the state of New York in 1787 and 1788. And they were really in the nature of political propaganda. They were intended to persuade the people of the state of New York that the United States Constitution, which had been drawn up the previous summer, should be adopted. And of course, you remember that after the Constitution was drawn up by the convention which met in Philadelphia during the summer of 1787, it was actually the hottest summer within living memory, and they had no air conditioning. And that is one of the reasons why they did not adopt the Bill of Rights, because after they had spent months in debating the structure and the powers of the new government, by then they wanted to leave. They wanted to go home and escape the heat. A motion for a Bill of Rights was made at the very end, but the delegates were not interested in accomplishing anything more. And after the convention drew up the Constitution, it was submitted to the different states. And the Constitution was ratified by conventions of each state. It was ratified state by state in conventions elected by the people of the different states. And when it came time for New York to decide on ratification, the authors of the Federalist Papers wrote them in newspapers in the state, and the purpose was to persuade the people of the state to elect Federalists, as those who supported the Constitution were then called, to persuade the people of the state to elect Federalists to the New York Convention, which was to vote to ratify or to reject the new Constitution. And of course, the Federalist Papers helped persuade the New York Convention to vote to adopt, to ratify. The Federalist Papers themselves were written under the pen name Publius by James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay, three of the leaders in the movement to establish a new constitution providing for a strong national government. Now, those who drew up the American system, the new constitutional system, and those who supported it, they were well aware that the federal system created by them was a political invention of the highest order. The form of federation offered to the American people in 1787 was novel, new in political theory and practice. Of course, the United States was not the first example of a federal body politic. In prior federations, however, as under the Articles of Confederation of 1781, under which America was governed before the Federal Constitution, the member states had generally agreed to obey the mandates of a common government for certain stipulated purposes, but the states had retained to themselves the right of ordaining and enforcing the laws of the Confederation, of the central government. As a member of the U.S. Supreme Court pointed out last year, the principal defect of the Articles of Confederation was that the new national government lacked the power to compel individual action. Instead, the central government had to rely upon the cooperation of state legislatures to achieve national goals. The framers of the Federal Constitution concluded that government by one sovereign through the agency of a second cannot be satisfactory. So they replaced the rudimentary federalism of the Articles of Confederation with the federal system that has since governed the American people. However, if we were to write a 1983 version of the Federalist, it would contain a description of the American system today, which would be a far cry from the classical concept of federalism. To the theoretical purist, in truth, even a state with a federal income tax is no longer a genuinely federal state. But pure federalism in its classical 18th century sense, pure federalism is wholly inconsistent with the stresses of 20th century political evolution. To seek to create federalism in its 18th century classical image is to indulge in a search for the impossible. Yet there are those, even today, who are engaged in so quixotic an undertaking. It has been customary for Americans over the years to assert that the federal system has changed drastically and has been, or should be, replaced by a new federalism. Thus, a few decades ago, the changed relation of balance of power brought about by the decline of so-called dual federalism, which I have discussed in my previous lectures, this changed balance of powers a few decades ago was customarily characterized as the new federalism. The outstanding feature of that new federalism was the growth of federal power, notably through the power of the purse, exercised through conditional grants in aid to the states, as I have described them to you. The recent expansion of federal authority has led to calls for still another new federalism, this time to reverse the trend of power to the center. In particular, there have been calls to lessen the dependence of the states upon federal grants, or at least to remove some of the conditions which must be met before federal funds are granted. And there have been calls for limiting federal conditions on grants if the political values of federalism are to be preserved in the face of fiscal centralization, one of the dominant themes of American federalism over the past 30 or 40 years. Most recently, President Reagan has made a new federalism proposal a cornerstone of his administration's program. In his annual State of the Union message, you know, under the Constitution, the President must deliver a message each January to the Congress which describes the current condition of the country, the State of the Union, as it's called. And in his State of the Union message on January 25th of this year, President Reagan stated that his federalism proposal was intended to restore to states and local governments their roles as dynamic laboratories of change in a creative society. Those are the president's words. The Reagan proposal has two principal parts. The first is to restore to the states important programs undertaken in recent years by the federal government, such as those providing financial assistance to families with dependent children and providing stamps for food purchases to the needy. The second part of the Reagan program is to replace so-called categorical federal grants to the states. The categorical grants are grants under which funds are given for specific narrow purposes under conditions specified in the grants. And the Reagan proposal is to replace these categorical grants with so-called block grants, under which funds are returned to the states with a minimum of controls. The block grants are made for general programs. For example, community development, law enforcement, and employment and manpower training. Provided the states spend the money for the general programs involved, they are free to use the grants, the funds, as they choose, with only a minimum of conditions which they must meet. Now, that's the Reagan program. However, there has been substantial resistance to the Reagan version of the new federalism, primarily because of federal unwillingness in Congress to give up the control that has accompanied most categorical grants. In addition, there are the fears of those who are helped by such grants that they need federal protection to ensure that the federal funds will be spent properly. In addition, perhaps paradoxically, the states themselves have not been receptive to the Reagan proposals because of the need to raise revenue to finance the programs which are now operated by the federal government. The guarantee of federal funds has proved more important, more attractive to the states than the possibility that the federal government will allow the states to secure revenues from sources that are now within the preserve of the federal taxing power. Even more important, I think, is the fact that even if the Reagan new federalism proposals were to be adopted, they would scarcely suffice to turn back the constitutional clock to the days of dual federalism. To turn over programs and funds to the states, that alone would scarcely be enough to reconstitute the states as equals with the national government in the American federal system. From a legal, from a juridical point of view, both the National League of Cities case, which I discussed last time, and the Reagan New Federalism have not substantially altered the trend toward federal predominance that has characterized this century. And we can see this from a 1982 decision on the matter, a decision last year by the U.S. Supreme Court, which confirms this point. The case in question is called Federal Energy Regulatory Commission against Mississippi. In it, the court considered the constitutionality of a 1978 federal law that requires state agencies to implement federal regulatory programs. Under this law, state agencies that regulate electric utilities under state law, you know that in the United States, generally speaking, provision of certain essential services, such as electricity, these services are not generally provided by government agencies. They are provided by private companies, which are called electric utilities. But these electric utilities operate under substantial governmental regulation, both state and federal. And under the federal law in this case, the state agencies that regulate these electric utilities under state law must conduct administrative proceedings to consider and determine whether 12 national rate design policies and service standards should be adopted and enforced with respect to each regulated electric utility, and similar obligations with respect to federal standards are imposed on state agencies that regulate natural gas utilities. These are the private companies which provide natural gas to consumers. Under this federal law, the federal Congress intended to impose a duty on state agencies to enforce federal policies for regulation of these electric and gas utilities. There is a direct impact by the federal law upon state power to make decisions and set policy, since that power of the states normally includes the power to decide which proposals are worthy of consideration, the order in which they should be considered, and the form in which they should be considered. The federal law forces the different state agencies to consider the national standards and removes from these agencies their discretion over scheduling how they will take up different proposals. And what this law does is really, this law sets the agenda of agencies which are part of the states, not of national government. Despite this, the court upheld the challenged federal law, rejecting the claim that it violated the 10th Amendment, under which all powers not granted under the Constitution to the federal government are reserved to the states. The court rejected the claim that this federal law violated the 10th Amendment or the principle of the National League of Cities case. The court concluded that the federal law did not invalidly impose commands upon the states because if a state gave up, abandoned utility regulation, or abolished its regulatory agency, it would not have to comply with the federal standards for regulation of electric and gas utility companies. But of course, this gives the states only a theoretical choice to continue to regulate if they agree to implement the federal law or to abandon utility regulation. And it's wholly impractical in the 1980s for any state to give up regulation of these companies which provide essential services. The reality is that in upholding the law, the court permitted the federal government to use state regulatory machinery to achieve federal goals. And here the state is not able to consider and promulgate regulations of its own choosing, but must instead spend its time considering the federal standards. The mandatory agenda to be considered by the state decision makers is set by the federal government. As characterized by a dissenting justice in the Supreme Court, this law makes state administrative bodies field offices of the national bureaucracy. The decision I spoke about in my last lecture, last month's decision in Equal Employment Opportunity Commission against Wyoming, this decision also reaffirms the predominance of federal power in the contemporary American system. You may remember that the Supreme Court there upheld a federal law which prohibits a state from requiring mandatory retirement of game wardens who reached the age of 55. As I pointed out in my last lecture, the court found that this law does not directly impair the state's ability to structure integral operations in areas of traditional governmental functions. And that was the reasoning of the court, as I discussed with you, the reasoning of the court in upholding this federal age discrimination law. The true situation, however, was quite otherwise, as was pointed out in a strong dissenting opinion by the Chief Justice Berger. Like the law in the National League of Cities case, the federal age discrimination law increases the cost of state government. Older workers are at the upper end of the pay scale. Their pension and health insurance costs are higher, and they involve increased disability costs. And there are other costs as well, non-economic costs. Employers, state employers, are prevented from hiring those best able to do the job. Older workers have the higher positions in any bureaucratic structure, and so a prohibition on mandatory retirement impedes promotion opportunities. This tends to make it harder for younger workers and tends to impede their incentive. It limits their incentive to strive for excellence. From this point of view, the federal age requirement has an impact upon the state's ability to structure and operate its civil service comparable to that of the wage and hour requirements invalidated in the National League of Cities case. And because of this federal age law, for example, as the dissent points out, there's a real danger that a fire may burn out of control because the firefighters are not physically able to cope, or that a criminal may escape because a law enforcement officer's reflexes are too slow to react swiftly enough to apprehend an offender. Even if the majority of the court is correct in its attempt to distinguish the age law from the wage and hour law invalidated in the National League of Cities case, it can hardly be denied that the Wyoming decision does subject the states to federal power in a manner that belies, that contradicts the notion of state equality with the federal government. Over a century ago, the Supreme Court declared that Congress has no power to impose upon a state officer as such any duty whatever and compel him to perform it. In its opinion in Federal Energy Regulatory Commission against Mississippi, the case I referred to a while ago, in the opinion there, the court referred to this now famous statement. But the court went on to say, recent cases demonstrate that this rigid and isolated statement, which suggests that the states and the federal government, in all circumstances, must be viewed as co-equal sovereigns, is not representative of the law today. The implication is clear, that the highest American court recognizes that despite the National League of Cities case and the Reagan New Federalism proposals, the states and the federal government can no longer be viewed as co-equal sovereigns. Instead, the national government now has the power to control areas of activity that half a century ago were considered within the reserved powers of the states. Federal authority in this respect may be illustrated, I think, dramatically by a law passed by Congress at the end of last year, in December 1982. The law in question involves the regulation of large motor trucks. Until Congress acted, the law on the matter had been settled by Supreme Court decisions in favor of state regulation. The court, a number of years ago, going back 40 years or more, the court has upheld the general power of the states to prescribe safety regulations for those using their highways. And the state power exists, and the regulations govern whether the motor vehicles are engaged in interstate or purely local travel. For example, there's no doubt that interstate vehicles, that is, vehicles traveling from state to state, while they're in a state, they must obey local traffic signals, local speed limits, and other state general safety regulations. And there are other illustrations, a state law which fixes maximum hours for continuous driving on the highways of the state. This is valid, even though it applies to interstate as well as local vehicles. And the theory is that local safety conditions are to be prescribed by local, by state governments, not by one rule fixed from Washington. Reasonable regulations governing driving adopted for safety purposes, the Supreme Court has said, this type of regulation comes within the powers of the states. And in fact, we've known this for years, that the manner in which motor vehicles may be operated may be regulated by the states and local governments, and such regulations present no constitutional difficulties. In fact, we have a case going back to our very beginning under which a sleigh, this goes back to the 1790s or early 1800s, I forget, but it goes back over 150 years before we had motor vehicles, where it was held that a state law requiring sleds used for commercial purposes to have bells to warn people that they were coming, this law had to be obeyed by all sleds, regardless of where they were being used. The states have not, however, limited themselves to safety regulations of this type. In a leading Supreme Court decision called South Carolina Highway Department against Barnwell Brothers, which the court decided in 1938. In that case, the state law prohibited the use on the highways of the states of trucks whose width exceeded a certain width and whose weight exceeded a certain amount, 90 inches in width, 20,000 pounds in weight. This law was upheld. And the reasoning is, again, it's pretty much the same reasoning as explained by the court. There are few subjects of state regulation affecting interstate commerce which are so peculiarly of local concern as is the use of the state's highways. Unlike the railroads, local highways are built, owned, and maintained by the state. The state is responsible for their safe and economical administration. Since interstate motor vehicles use roads in the states, and the roads with us are built and they are maintained by the states, though in recent years with very substantial federal financial aid. The railroads, on the other hand, were constructed by private corporations, and there was no governmental role there. And since we have motor vehicles using roads in the states, which are built and maintained by the states, they are subject to state regulations which promote safety and which prevent wear and tear on the roads. The state is not limited to regulations as to the manner in which vehicles may be operated. It may also prevent the wear and hazards due to excessive size of vehicles and weight of load. In the Barnwell Brothers case, the challenged law was aimed at both safety and highway conservation, and the Supreme Court upheld the law on that basis. Now, this does not mean that in the American federal system, the states may impose any and all regulations upon the size and weight of vehicles. Where it is not clearly shown that a state law which imposes a burden upon interstate trucking does promote safety, the law must fall. This principle was applied 2 years ago in a 1981 case, Cassell against Consolidated Freightways Corporation, it was called. The state there, the state of Iowa, had a law restricting trucks on its highways to 55 feet in length. That law was ruled invalid as applied to interstate trucks because the state had not shown that the restriction did promote safety. The trucker in the case had presented massive evidence to show that the 55-foot limit did not contribute to safety. The trucker showed in detail that trucks of over 55 feet were at least as safe as those shorter than the limit. And the state did not present any evidence to contradict the evidence to this effect by the trucker. According to the Supreme Court in this Cassell decision, the state law violated the Commerce Clause of the Federal Constitution because it placed a substantial burden upon interstate commerce and made only the most speculative contribution to highway safety. As the court's opinion put it, whereas here, the state's safety interest has been found to be illusory, and its regulations impair significantly the federal interest in efficient and safe interstate transportation, the state law cannot be harmonized with the Commerce Clause. It should, however, be emphasized that this Cassell decision does not overrule the Barnwell Brothers decision on the power of the states to regulate the size of interstate trucks. Only unreasonable regulations, which are not shown to have any direct relationship to safety, only such regulations will fall. And under the earlier Supreme Court case, the Barnwell case in 1938, under this case, many states have laws like that in the Barnwell case, restricting, limiting the width and weight of trucks. In addition, 14 states now have laws prohibiting 65-foot and longer so-called double or tandem trailer trucks on the highways. These are trucks with a big trailer, and they range up to 75 feet in length, something like 25 meters in length, and 14 states have had laws which prohibit trucks of this type, double trucks, trucks with combined trailers, which are longer than 65 feet, and the state laws prohibit the use of such trucks on their highways. Such trucks have been called killer trucks because of the number of fatal accidents in which they have been involved, as well as the excessive highway damage caused by them. Indeed, according to a 1982 study by the U.S. Department of Transportation, such trucks do at least 87 times as much damage as the heaviest auto. And any driver who has had to contend with these giant trucks on the highways, any driver realizes what a hazard, what a danger they present to all other traffic. Despite the Cassell decision, the 1981 decision, which I have briefly mentioned, that decision striking down the state law limiting trucks to 55 feet, despite that decision, it has been assumed that the state laws prohibiting the 65-foot and longer double trailer trucks are valid because of the clear effect, the adverse impact of these tandem trucks upon both safety and highway conservation. But the Congress has now stepped in and effectively overruled the laws of the 14 states prohibiting the 65-foot and longer tandems. A federal law enacted just a few months ago in December 1982 provides that no state shall establish, maintain, or enforce any regulation of commerce which has the effect of prohibiting use in the state of trucks with trailers which have an overall length limit of up to 75 feet. And this provision applies to all state limitations on federally assisted highways. And these are all the main highways of the states, because all the main state highways have now been built with substantial federal funds. And under this recent law of Congress, no state may prohibit these double trailer trucks up to some 75 feet in length from operating on federally assisted highways, which means all the important roads in the states. In addition, the recent federal law provides that no funds under the Federal Aid Highway Act, and this is the law under which substantial federal financial assistance is given to the states for the construction and maintenance of roads. And the December 1982 law provides that no funds under this Aid for Highways law shall be given to any state which does not permit the use on highways in the state by these double trailer trucks with a weight up to 80,000 pounds. These provisions of the 1982 federal law effectively prevail over the state laws which prohibit the 65-foot and over tandem trailer trucks, as well as those state laws which contain weight limitations upon those trucks, such as those permitted by the Barnwell Brothers case, the 1938 Supreme Court decision. And this is true under established constitutional principles. The federal law will prevail over the state laws, either as a direct regulation of interstate commerce, which preempts the field of truck lengths by setting a national limit, or by use of the federal power of the purse. No funds to states which violate this federal prohibition. States which continue to prohibit these large double trailer trucks on their highways, or which do not permit trucks within the federal limits, will lose federal highway assistance. The states receive substantial federal funds for the construction and maintenance of highways, as I told you, and they could scarcely operate their highway systems without such federal aids. Because of this, ultimately, the states will permit the huge double trailers to use their roads rather than give up the federal funds. Now, this is true, even though the federal law annuls the policies of the 14 states with laws prohibiting the large trailer trucks. And it's true even though under this law, New York, Chicago, Boston, and other large American cities are being forced by the new legislation to open their battered streets to these destructive large trucks. The New York State and New York City Transportation Commissioners have claimed that these large trailer trucks would impose inordinate safety and traffic management problems for New York City. And in a large city, it really is unbelievable what will happen. And there have been serious protests. Just before I left the United States 2 weeks ago, the state of Connecticut passed a new law. You know, I said there were 14 states which prohibit these large trucks. Now the state of Connecticut has also passed a law prohibiting trucks 65 feet and over from their road. So there are 15. And the cities such as New York are really protesting bitterly and saying that they will enforce their laws prohibiting these trucks. But legally, they have no such power to do so. Ultimately, unless these protests persuade Congress to amend the law, and I think that is their purpose. Legally, they have no status. Juridically, the new law passed by Connecticut is void, because it conflicts with a federal law on the subject. But if the states succeed in this, they will induce Congress to pass a new law repealing the prohibition on the states. But if they do not do so, the federal law will prevail, and the impact is tremendous. The day before I left on April 8th, the New York Times had its first editorial on this subject, and the title was Highway Monsters and City Streets. And the Times was describing in the editorial what effect, the destructive effect, that these monster trucks would have on the streets of a city such as New York, which can hardly support the tremendous traffic we now have, but with nothing like these gigantic, gargantuan trucks. But all of this does not change the effect of the new federal law legally in overriding the state laws which prohibit these monster double trailer trucks. And unless, as I say, Congress does change or repeal the provision, there is no doubt that legally the federal courts will hold that the states are controlled by this new federal law, regardless of what it does to their highways, regardless of the danger imposed on their people, and even though this clearly is against the policy which these states have followed for many years. Now, both Federal Energy Regulatory Commission against Mississippi and the 1982 federal law on truck length and weight show how far the balance in the American system has now shifted toward the federal side of the scale. The starting point of the American system may, as we have seen, been the concept of dual federalism, under which states and nation were looked upon as equals, with each having reserved to it an exclusive area of authority in which it could act. This concept was, as I showed you in my second lecture, maintained in its essential aspects for over a century by a series of Supreme Court decisions invalidating attempts by the federal government to encroach upon the field reserved to the states. But the equilibrium between state and federal power has been drastically altered during this century. the need for the exertion of national power to meet the requirements of present-day government has led to the abandonment of the notion of governmental equality as the keystone of the American system of federalism. The events which have occurred during this century show the strength of federal power in the United States. And I've described that in my second and third lectures. And of course, everything that has happened during this century underscores the predominance of federal authority in the contemporary federal system in the United States. The American social and economic system during this century has more and more been subjected to regulation and control by Washington. The national government's power over commerce, the power to regulate economic affairs, this is interpreted so as to subject even enterprises which have only a remote effect upon the national economy to detailed federal regulation. And as the authority of the nation in this respect has grown, that of the states has suffered a corresponding decrease. For state action in the American system is barred where federal power inconsistent therewith has validly been exerted. And that is, of course, true in the case of truck regulation. When the federal government, at the end of last year, when Congress passed this new law requiring the states to allow these monster trucks on their highways, the state laws inconsistent therewith must fall. The protests, as I tried to show you, are really political in nature. But in the end, if Congress does not change the law, the state laws will fall and there will be a decrease in state power. The power which the states had before this 1982 federal law to regulate motor trucks on their highways, this state power will have been eliminated by the federal law. In addition, national authority has been greatly expanded by recent reliance upon the federal power to tax and spend to promote the general welfare. The position of the states has deteriorated further by the constantly increasing reliance of state governments upon funds granted by Washington, which have normally been granted only upon conditions which have subjected the state recipients to varying degrees of federal control. It is the importance of these federal grants in aid that led an important official study to conclude, with regard to federal-state relations in the American system, prior to 1900, the question was largely a legal problem. Since that time, it has become increasingly an economic problem. The development of American federalism, which has been described by me in these lectures, characterized as it has been by the growth of federal power, this development poses the problem of the future of the American states. Is the trend toward federal growth likely to continue with the eventual substitution of a unitarian form of government for the federal system as its possible ultimate phase? An answer to this question is not an easy one. Mere logical considerations might demand an affirmative reply. The existence of the American states often involves a needless and wasteful duplication of governmental structures and services. And even if organs of local government are considered necessary, they would be better organized if the United States were divided along regional lines rather than according to the present state boundaries, which were normally chosen for anything but considerations of governmental efficiency. The state boundaries are largely historical accidents, and in terms of governmental efficiency, I suppose worse boundaries could not have been chosen in many cases. because you have a state like Rhode Island, which is minute in size, relatively large in population, which is a state, just the way the state of California, which in area must be more than 100 times larger. Or you have the state of Nevada, which has a very large area, but has a population of less than 1 million, which also is a full state, the way the state of California, which in population is probably 40 times the size. So in terms of efficiency, you could think of better regional units. The states are the results largely of, I call them historical accidents. Most of them were not accidents, but largely the result of history. And you could easily, political scientists and others have often redrawn the map of the United States on what they call more efficient regional lines. Yet, though the trend toward increasing federal authority is likely to continue in the United States, it is most unlikely that it will lead in the foreseeable future to the complete curtailment of the state governments. Those who think otherwise ignore the strength which still remains in the American tradition of federalism. It retains and will continue to retain its vitality because it has values which, difficult though they may be to articulate, have not been destroyed by rapid transportation and the growth of national markets. Maintenance of strong state governments imparts a democratic strength to the American system not found in centralized monolithic administration. If now and then some state does not regulate according to the federal standard, that may be a small price to pay for preserving the vigor of the federal system. In his 1983 State of the Union address, as I've already indicated, President Reagan referred to the states as dynamic laboratories of change in a creative society. In doing so, he was relying on the famous concept of federalism, expounded over half a century ago by one of the greatest American judges, Mr. Justice Brandeis. And Brandeis said, "It is one of the happy incidents of the federal system that a single courageous state may, if its citizens choose, serve as a laboratory and try novel social and economic experiments without risk to the rest of the country." This Brandeis concept was expanded upon only last year by Justice O'Connor, the first woman appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. She dissented from the decision in the case I've already discussed, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission against Mississippi, and in her dissent she said, "Courts and commentators frequently have recognized that the 50 states serve as laboratories for the development of new social, economic, and political ideas. This state innovation is no judicial myth." She then listed some important state innovations, such as female suffrage, unemployment insurance, minimum wage laws, so-called no-fault automobile insurance, and environmental protection laws. These all started in states, in the states, with state laws. Thus, as Chief Justice Berger put it only last month, flexibility for experimentation not only permits each state to find the best solution to its own problems, it is the means by which each state may profit from the experience and activities of all the rest. According to Justice O'Connor, however, the concept of the states as laboratories is only one of the valuable aspects of federalism. In addition to promoting experimentation, she says, federalism enhances the opportunity to all citizens to participate in representative government. If all laws are made by a faraway national legislature, the lessons of self-government cannot be learned. If we want to preserve the ability of citizens to learn democratic processes through participation in local government, citizens must retain the power to govern, not merely administer, their local problems. Even more important is the fact that, as Justice O'Connor emphasizes, the American federal system provides a very important check on governmental power. In another famous passage, Justice Brandeis once noted, "The doctrine of separation of powers was adopted by the Convention of 1787 not to promote efficiency, but to preclude the exercise of arbitrary power. The same is true of the division of governmental power between state and national authorities. The diffusion of power between federal and state authority is an essential safeguard against undue concentrations of public power. The basic dangers inherent in over-centralized administration were stated in classic terms over a century ago by Alexis de Tocqueville. He said, "I cannot conceive that a nation can live and prosper without a powerful centralization of government. But I am of the opinion that a centralized administration is fit only to enervate the nations in which it exists by incessantly diminishing their local spirit. Although such an administration can bring together at a given moment, on a given point, all the disposable resources of a people, it injures the renewal of those resources. It, a centralized administration, may ensure a victory in the hour of strife, but it gradually relaxes the sinews of strength. It may help admirably the transient greatness of a man, but not the durable prosperity of a nation." That's de Tocqueville. When we consider the future of American federalism, we must consider more than mere claims of governmental effectiveness. To most Americans, their states are as much a part of their political system as is the government in Washington. Each state has its own particular features, and some of them can look back upon a history of which they are entitled to be proud. Local patriotism and sentimental attachment to the particular state have lost none of their vigor. "The states," aptly declares an English observer, Professor Harold J. Lasky, "the states are provinces of which the sovereignty has never since 1789 been real. But they are provinces which, with all their limitations, have something of the magic of Athens and of Rome, of London and of Paris and of Florence. They breed in most of their citizens an undeniable parochialism, but the states are few in which there is not something akin to loveliness in their parochialism. Though the American states may decline even more from the position of independent sovereigns which they possessed upon the founding of the Republic, their continuance as separate governmental entities seems assured. It is certainly not reasonable to expect their status to become similar to that of an English county or still less of a French department. Even if state power continues to decrease and federal control to grow, the American states will continue to possess authority to which organs of local government in most of Europe cannot pretend. The American states will still possess an initiative in lawmaking which can be exercised in the absence of federal action in the field. It is they who will still be responsible for the functioning of local administrative and judicial machinery. Education, police, public health, welfare, and a host of other functions appear likely, at least on the local level, to continue to be administered by state officials. Their role will continue to be a large one as compared with most European organs of local government. The American states may be under growing federal control, yet it is unlikely that they will ever have to look to Washington in determining their behavior, as most areas of local government in Europe still have to look to the governmental center before they can make important decisions or innovations. The American states will continue to have a vital role in ensuring the values which even a watered-down federalism will still possess in the United States. Thank you.